Movement Alternatives Women for a New Era, or DAWN, is a network of feminist scholars, researchers and activists from the economic south working for economic and gender justice and sustainable and democratic development. This recording is made available by DAWN as a way of sharing its feminist critical analysis of the global environment through the voices of women from the south. Other recordings are available for download at www.dawnnet.org and may be used freely following proper citation. DAWN Podcasts, the voices of women creating a just world.
Okay, the topic is very difficult, you know, and very challenging, but that's always the exciting part, and that's why we're here today, because that's the challenge we're facing directly. And what I'm going to do is mainly speak a little bit from the Asia-Pacific perspective. Basically, if we, first of all, do we already have the foundations for the alternatives? And Butch had opened this session saying the alternatives have been said maybe for a very long time. It's been out there. It's just not being implemented. But are we at the stage where we're ready to implement them? And the conversations when the crisis hit was that now is the time. It's a time to reconsider. Now is the time to shift our paradigms. And are we you know, at the tipping point, I suppose, is the question? Yeah. No? Okay, that ends my presentation. No. So what I'm going to do in terms of trying to identify whether we do have foundations for that is to look at the economic stimulus packages at the Asia-Pacific region, because, you know, there's some sense that, okay, we need to do something, so let's try that. And so a quick overview of that. Then secondly is to look at the internationally coordinated response, or perhaps lack of it, as our previous speakers have already mentioned. You know, as assess that really very quickly. Third is to see if there's some lessons from the 1997 crisis, and you know, did we learn from 97? What is it? 13 years later, are we making the same mistakes? And to end is really, forgive me, but I might go into a bit of an abstraction, you know, in theory, because basically in avoidance of the tendency to have a checklist or a blueprint, you know, that we all will follow, a mistake that clearly has been made with the Washington Consensus and its application. Okay, so given that sense of approach, first to start with, that with Asia Pacific, in a survey, a very quick overview survey of the UNSCAP, there's a total of $1 trillion available in fiscal stimulus packages, but actually half of that money is from China. The situation initially from them and is that while that sounds like a large sum of money in terms of proportion of the budget deficit as a proportion of GDP, that's not really much. East Southeast Asian economies have been running an average of -3% budget deficit. South Asia is about 5 to 7% budget deficit. Fairly conservative figures. So in terms of fiscal space, in actuality they're being conservative, but there is a possibility that there's more space, and maybe at some point I'll be able to show you some figures. In general, in a survey of 22 or 32 countries globally on fiscal stimulus packages, most of that money is being spent on financial measures to save the banking industry. Then the rest of the money is on infrastructure. The developing countries tend to prefer infrastructure far more than developed countries. And then for labor market measures, where you would think a lot of economies would focus on because there's plenty of unemployment or job loss, actually only 3% of the spending was on labor market measures for for the rich countries, and the poor countries or the developing countries spent less than 1%. Social protection did better than labor market measures. About 10.8% of spending for developed countries was on social protection, and 6.8% was the spending ratio for developing and emerging countries. Now, okay, interesting numbers. obviously, labor market and social protection is not the priority when you would think that that would be the first choice. But the nature of the interventions are also unclear in terms of how well they meet the requirements of women and of gender equality. So, for example, I think the one that's been going around a lot is just what kind of employment, you know, infrastructure spending was implemented to generate employment. But we know that the occupational segregation of labor markets is very clear, that certain occupations, that women and men are concentrated in very specific occupations. And as far as infrastructure is concerned, that's not exactly the jobs for females. Now, in Southeast Asia, most of the job loss was in garments, in electronics, footwear, and so on. So one can imagine it's very difficult to shift employment from garments to public works or road construction and the like. So like I said, you know, there's certain dimensions that we need to take a look at in order to actually do a proper assessment. Next slide, please. And then question about, again, occupational segregation, but particularly unpaid work in terms of the labor market measures, which have largely been about training and retraining programs, right? To where and to what, you know, especially when many of the, at least the high-end, high-rich countries are looking to restructure their economies towards the high technology, the green economy. Has there been the kind of training provided to women so that they can find jobs in this new economy, so to speak? So it's a question I'm raising because I didn't have enough information on the details of the programs. And then a favorite approach for social protection in the region has been cash transfers, but we need to study that with respect to the employment generation policies. You know, cash transfers help to some extent, but the sustainable livelihoods is what we're really after if we're looking for a shift, a paradigm shift. Okay, what about the global, excuse me if I'm running things very quickly, but globally, there's actually not much money involved. It's only the IMF who's getting money at $500 billion in new arrangements to borrow. The new money from the IMF has been lent out to Eastern European area, about 82% of that. Then 1.6% to Africa. Only Pakistan and Mongolia have borrowed from the IMF. Basically, the Asian countries have avoided IMF, and with good reason, because they were not treated very well back in 1997. The World Bank actually doesn't have new money. The World Bank needs to rely on its IDA replenishment to pay for any new programs that might come out as a result of this crisis. And my sense is, having looked at some of the figures, is that they're reclassifying old loans in the social sector and calling it programs under this facility. Okay? So I'm not really convinced that there is money coming from the bank. The UN has no money. This is not news at all. The CEB report from last year was saying, okay, we're going to check if we have money, and if we don't have money, maybe we'll ask from the World Bank, which doesn't have money. So this is our situation right now. To illustrate on the bank especially, here's how they break down the financing facility framework. And you can see in terms of the last row that most of the money is really infrastructure, $45 billion. The social protection part is here, which will come from the IDA. Actually, most of this will come from IDA operations. When the multi-donor trust fund, I switched my letters. The multi-donor trust fund, I think, my guess is that the bank is trying to get the money to developing countries by avoiding the strict requirements of IDA. In order to get a loan from IDA, you have to fulfill a certain score for the CPIA. You have to be a good performer economy, which means you have certain macro policies that you follow that the World Bank likes, that we have raised many questions about. But if IDA is the basis for funding, many low-income countries do not fulfill the CPIA requirements, the IDA requirements. So they're not going to get this money. It's only the good economies and I put that in both, who will actually be able to answer. So first of all, most of the money is infrastructure. Second of all, it's tough to meet DIDA requirements. So that's the situation globally. So I'm not, how about aid? Well, you know, the G20 got together and they said, okay, we'll pull together the money, whatever we need, and we'll spend $50 billion on social protection. I actually tried to look for the $50 billion, but was not successful. So if you know where that is, I'd really like to know. I'm guessing it's partly bank, you know, the MTDFs, but I couldn't add them up to 50, so help me here. I'd really like to know. These are the forecasts from the OECD, which is the group of countries who are the major donors. And the forecast is actually not so bad looking, but in a paper by Hal Lev, when he was looking at the correlations between aid and growth, he found that there might be a lag in terms of a reduction in aid when there is a recession for the donor countries. That is, it will take show up a year or two later, you know, the decline in aid. And that's probably because there's a little bit more multi-annual programming going on in the donor countries so that the aid doesn't drop until about two years later. So we may not see the drop until last year or this year. I was not successful in getting a forecast for 2009. Maybe it was too bad and they didn't want to release it. But they did have forecasts for 2010, but there were 15 footnotes to the forecast, meaning, you know, there are certain exceptions to be noted. So, plus the danger of what happened in Greece last week, possibility that Spain is not looking good and Italy is not looking good. So if we have fiscal deficit problems that will emerge or worsen with Europe, then the possibility is that aid might help, at least as far as financial flows are concerned, are getting not so real. Okay, so the gender thing is that it actually looks good. The numbers actually look good. There's been a doubling of the amount of money in terms of disbursements between 2007 and 2008, doing much, much better than total sector allocable aid. This is just the portion of aid where you that goes into specific sectors, but it could be a statistical artifact. I don't know yet. But anyway, the OECD can do absolutely wonderful marketing for it, for themselves. First, on 1997, when the Asian economies knew that it's not going to work, they had to self-insure. And the self-insurance is through the reserve pooling. First, they racked up a lot of reserves for themselves. And then, these are figures of how much reserves there are for the East Asian. They are above average, above the recommended rate in terms of the number of months imports. It's more than 3 months. So they're hoarding their money because they're afraid that they're not going to be able to find new money if there is a crash. Most of the money is being held in U.S. dollar instruments, and that's that side. But we know that the U.S. dollar is going to face also very large deficit problems soon, and the value of the dollar is going down, so we don't really know what this might mean as far as a reserve pool is concerned for the Asians. The second from 1997 is also a self-reliance, but from the individual or household level. A strategy that you know that you can't ask for help from others, from your own government, so you just help yourself. These are just social protection coverage figures to give you a sense that the region is not well known for social protection. It was quite a surprise to, in fact, see social protection packages in fiscal stimulus, in their fiscal stimulus. So, from Asia-Pacific, it's just self-reliance, either self-reliance at the macro level or self-reliance from individually. But here's my abstraction. What are we looking for and the alternative that we're looking for? Not so much in terms of policies, but the outcome that we want to see. And it's really shifting the responsibilities more broadly in terms of who performs care in the economy across a much broader set of institutions beyond the care that's performed within households. That's still a target that macro policies still need to achieve. Next. Finally, in response to the question or the statement about where's the political will, you know, the alternatives have been there, I think that the question of the second bullet on agency and institutional change, how does that go about? How well do we understand the process of social transformation? Right. If we have a few answers already as far as alternatives are concerned, how do we move that forward? I mean, can we get the 8,000 women here to the Financing for Development meetings to demand for the kinds of policies that we are looking for? I don't normally see the 8,000 women in FFD. I remember the G77 and China had a statement last October in a meeting that was preparing for this event, for Beijing Plus 15. It was for Beijing, but the second paragraph had a reference to how important FFD, and the Doha Review is for gender equality. How many women's statements out there are going to echo this point? Right? You know, so what's going to happen? We'll end up with self-insurance as the only strategy we have because we're not, you know, where we need to be. You know, and so that's the question of agency and institutional change is something that we really need to get a better grasp of in order to answer precisely the title of this session on alternatives.
Development Alternatives for Women for a New Era, or DAWN, is a network of feminist scholars, researchers, and activists from the economic South working for economic and gender justice and sustainable and democratic development. This recording is done by DAWN as a way of sharing its feminist critical analysis of the global environment through the voices of women from the South. Other recordings are available for download at www.dawnnet.org and may be used freely following proper citation. DAWN Podcasts, the voices of women creating a just world.